Congressman Paul joins us on the phone, and nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And you've defined your campaign as being the candidate who wants to most limit the role of the federal government. You represent a coastal congressional district in Texas, yet you've consistently argued that we should slash FEMA, the federal agency responsible for responding to disasters in the aftermath of a hurricane. You've repeated that.
Yes, I just think it is a serious problem, and that's why I don't think we should let it be dealt with by bureaucrats in Washington, because they don't have a very good record. A lot of people would like to paint myself with a brush that says that if you don't want the federal government to do it, you don't want to solve the problem. But sometimes, you know, when the federal government gets involved, they don't do a very good job, and that is my point. Matter of fact, the federal government invites more problem by offering what they call insurance, but, you know, against flooding and wind. But the truth is it's no longer insurance if the government says they're always going to bail you out. So people who enjoy the benefits of living on the beach and close to the water really are guaranteed that their houses will be rebuilt. And they said, well, we can't get insurance otherwise. Well, they can't get it because it's real expensive, because it's very dangerous. So it's a matter of risk, and I think that's an objection that I've had. And besides, I've had more complaints about FEMA than any other agency the whole time I've been in Congress, and I have a coastal district. And there's too many stories about what FEMA did down and with Katrina. So there are so many arguments that that's not the most efficient way to deal with a problem like natural disasters.
Well, if FEMA does not provide disaster relief, who should?
Well, who's FEMA? FEMA's the taxpayers and its debt. They're $20 billion in debt already. I think the states should do it. You know, when when Katrina was such a disaster, there were a lot of complaints that the guard units for the states that were involved, many of their guard unit people were overseas, you know, worrying about war disasters. Matter of fact, I think it would be better if they were home worrying about our kind of problems here at home. But I'd also bring some of the money home. See, I'm not opposed under the conditions, because I was opposed to the concept even when it was imposed on us by an executive order, not by the Congress, but by executive order. But I've always said that, you know, once we get involved in a program, you just don't walk away from it if you can come up with another reason, another way of dealing with it. But we don't have any money. We have to borrow the money, which we're just kidding ourselves, and I consider the fiscal mess we're in to be very, very serious. So what I have said is, you know, why don't we cut $10 billion a month out of the war going on over in Afghanistan, which is a total disaster, put half of that toward the deficit, and put half of it back into our infrastructure or for the needs of the people we have taught to be dependent, and actually try to work our way out of this. So I think that that approach is a very responsible way of trying to deal with both the crisis as well as our financial mess that we're in.
And I don't know if you heard the news today, but President Obama has asked to address a joint meeting of Congress on the evening of September 7th, which is coincidentally, according to the White House, happens to be the date of the next GOP presidential debate. Which event do you plan to attend?
I hadn't thought much about it, because I guess I heard about that just a few minutes ago. But I sort of, you know, I just wonder about motivations, because, you know, in the Republican primary, there were people who always tried to upstage the other members. You know, we had Perry doing something when we had the straw vote, and then we have Palin doing things in order to get attention. So I don't know. I just wonder about the motivation of all this to pick. I mean, it's very obvious that he's picking at a time when you know, a debate is going on. Why didn't he do it on Tuesday? You know, so I have no idea what the answer to that, but it seems a little bit unusual to do something like that.
Ken?
Congressman, the headline about a month ago or so was that Michelle Bachmann wins the Iowa straw poll, with very little mention that Ron Paul finished closely behind her. And the other headline was that Tim Pawlenty drops out of the race. Then the more recent headline was that Rick Perry is taking over Mitt Romney's role as frontrunner. As a member of Congress from Texas, you've obviously had some dealings with Rick Perry. And, of course, we'll see Perry in the debate next week. But what's your sense of how do you what's your relationship with Rick Perry, and how do you see him as a presidential candidate?
Well, I think he's a formidable candidate. I mean, he's the governor of a big state. I don't agree with his politics. You know, the Tea Party people had a candidate running against him for governor, you know, last go-around, and she had no money and got 20%. But I haven't met the governor, and I don't know him personally, and we haven't had any personal dealings, so I can't comment on that. But I know that so many of his political positions are not the same as mine.
Could you point out one or two?
Well, politically speaking, I mean, he was a chairman here in Texas for Al Gore's campaign in 88, and he was for compelling, 10-year-old girls all to get inoculations for HPV, and he did that by executive order. I don't believe in executive orders, and that was overridden by the legislature. And there are quite a few other things in his past that philosophically I wouldn't agree with. His comments on foreign policy haven't been exactly what I would like.
Well, let's get some callers in on the conversation. We're speaking, of course, with the presidential candidate, Ron Paul, a congressman from Texas, and 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Josh is on the line from Milwaukee.
Hey, Congressman Neal. I just had a quick question. Do you feel at all vindicated in the wake of your last campaign that maybe you saw the debt crisis coming from a mile away and that maybe you deserved a little more platform for speaking in the last election? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Josh.
Well, I've never thought I get that question asked a lot, and I never put it in personal terms. Because I think the views that I've expressed are vindicated. I think Austrian economics has been vindicated, something that I have followed since the 1960s, because it was the Austrian economists that predicted that the Bretton Woods agreement, the monetary system, the gold standard, would break down, which it did in August of 1971. So, yes, if you understand Austrian economics, you can anticipate bubbles. You can't tell when the crisis actually will hit because there's other things that determine the precise timing. But we do know that if you run up debt and print money, that the dollar will lose value and it will wipe out the middle class eventually. And that is what I fear we're facing. That's why I'm such a so determined to try to pay for the things that we do, whether it's war or whatever. Of course, I don't want the war to go on because I think they're also unnecessary. So, yes, I think the philosophy of liberty and the Constitution hopefully has been vindicated to some degree because it was the predictions by those of us who believe in it that some of these problems would come, and they certainly are here, and they're going to get a lot worse. I mean, next year the financial problems are going to be much worse because we're doing nothing in Washington. Nobody will consider cutting the spending, the $10 billion a month, and the war is accelerating in Afghanistan. This is one place where the American people, the majority, want us to come home. They're tired of it all. But both party leaders are all for this. No matter what they say on their campaigns, they get in office and they pursue this global warmongering stuff that I think is bankrupting our country.
Ken?
Congressman, one of the most memorable moments of the 2008 campaign, I think, was your clash, I guess, at the debate with Rudy Giuliani over maybe the cause of 9/11. As we approach the 10-year anniversary of 9/11, what does it mean to you, and do you think, and how do you think that the American people are seeing it, and what vantage point do you see the American people viewing 9/11 10 years later?
Well, I'm saddened by it all because we haven't changed anything. And we've made things much worse. For instance, suicide terrorism is one of the greatest threat we have. People who want to commit these kind of acts, it's so difficult to defend ourselves against. But, you know, before we invaded Iraq for the wrong reason, there was no al-Qaeda there. It had nothing to do with 9/11. But before we invaded Iraq, the Iraqis had never committed any acts of suicide terrorism. By 2007, they were committing over 300 acts of terrorism against Americans or allies of Americans. So suicide terrorism, our greatest threat, is directly related to our presence in Arab countries and propping up puppet governments in that region. And there's been total denial of this. They won't pay any attention. So we're not safer. We're more broke than ever. And the evidence is out there to explain exactly the direct correlation between our presence over there and the dangers we face.
Email from Christopher in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. I understand and agree with most of your positions on issues currently concerning the people of the United States. An issue I have not heard you talk about much, and which I also didn't see on your website, is the environment. I believe certain environmental issues require governmental oversight. Things like water sources and federally protected land can be misused and abused if each state is left to fend for itself and regulate itself. What's your stand on in the environment? How do you recommend we protect things like water tables and shared water sources, such as the Great Lakes?
Well, I think it's an important question because I have written somewhat about this. I don't probably talk about it as much as I should. But my contention is that during the Industrial Revolution, big government and big corporations became pretty good buddies, and they quite freely polluted our air and our water. I was raised in the city of Pittsburgh. Our rivers were sewers, and our skies were not much better. They were essentially cleaned up with local city ordinances a long time before the EPA. But this could be managed in a free market society if you have strict respect for private property. Because if you and I have property next to each other, neither of us have a right to pollute your air or your water. So property rights are very, very important. Even when it comes to water, in Texas they've developed pretty clearly the property rights of oil. So people can't drill oil next to your farm and suck out all the oil under your land because it's your property. And the laws are written pretty good for that. So property rights can do this. And the basic principle that you cannot pollute your neighbor's property is a pretty good one. But I think there are times when you do need the government to enforce those laws. The more local, the better. But there will be times when the federal government has to be involved because, our air goes across state boundaries. Water goes from one state to another. So under those circumstances, I think that we should have the federal government involved.
Presidential candidate Ron Paul, the political junkie Ken Rudin is with us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go next to John. John with us from Alexandria, Virginia.
Hi, Congressman. I'm calling because I'm an entrepreneur. I run my own business, and I love doing that. But one of the concerns that I have is that it seems like a lot of the discussion in Washington focuses on what's best for big businesses. And, you know, there's talk about people who make lots of money as job creators. But a lot of the proposals that are out there to do anything from changing the tax code to altering Social Security so that you can invest in you know, big businesses don't necessarily affect me. So I wanted to know, what would you think that you could do and what the federal government should do for people like me? And would you be willing to take that to your competitors during the debates and challenge them to make changes to the tax code and to entitlements that don't just benefit the biggest out there, but also benefit those who are seeking to innovate on their own?
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think the system in D.C. is very much controlled by big banks and big corporations, the military-industrial complex, giant farms that get their subsidies. So they have lobbyists, and they get their tax codes and the regulatory system benefiting them. Very often, corporations come to Washington for regulation because they know if you're a small businessman, you don't have the same ability to get around the system and have the tax, your tax attorneys and different attorneys. But in talking about subsidies, though, I don't want any subsidies, so I don't want to give them to the big guys to take an advantage of the smaller people. And I want the regulations to be the same way. We should not allow the big companies to dictate, regulations. For instance, on both the Democrats and the Republicans, when they have medical care reforms, they protect drug companies and the insurance companies. And that shouldn't be so. Everybody should be protected equally. Nobody should get any special privileges. Everybody should obey the rules of contracts and private property rights.
John, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
And we just have a minute or so left with you, Congressman, but I wanted to ask, your supporters claim that we in the media don't take you seriously enough. You're dismissed as a second-tier candidate. What do you have to do to be taken seriously as a first-tier candidate? Where are you going to go and win something?
Mm-hmm. Well, there'll be plenty of chances pretty soon. We do, you know, pretty darn well in all the straw votes, which proves that we have support, we can raise money, we can organize, and people are energized. But the numbers still have to come out in elections, which probably will, the real test will be in January. But from our inside, campaign organization, we do know that it's easy to raise money. The volunteers are more than ever. The country has shifted. Attitudes have changed. The majority of the American people don't like the war, and they're looking at the monetary system.
Well, Congressman Paul, good luck to you on your campaign, and thanks very much for being with us again on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Ron Paul, who represents the 14th District of Texas, he's already announced he will not be running for re-election to focus on the presidential campaign. And, Ken Rudin, is he going to be accepted as a first-tier candidate?
Well, compared to 2008, he certainly is. The question is whether the party has moved so far to him or whether he's shifted with the times. But he's certainly more going to be a much more prominent force than he was in 2008.
Political junkie Ken Rudin joins us every Wednesday. Next Tuesday, his column comes back at npr.org/junkie. And, well, that scuttlebutt and puzzle, too. And he'll be back here next Wednesday. But coming up, the dreaded high school reunion. It took Clarence Page 20 years to work up the nerve to go. Now he says they're therapeutic. He joins us next. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.